Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. I'm Elizabeth Slattery, Vice President of Practice Groups. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. Now please enjoy today's conversation.
Hello everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar. Today, August 11th, 2026, we are delighted to host a conversation entitled The Faster Labor Contracts Act, What's at Stake for Collective Bargaining? My name is Emma Blakemore, and I'm an Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. In the interest of time, I'll keep our introductions brief, but if you would like to know more about any of our panelists, you can access their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have Thomas Beck, Sharon Block, Roger King, and Daniel Kishi as our panelists, with Alex McDonald serving as our moderator. Mr. Beck is a member of the Federal Service Impasses Panel for the Federal Labor Relations Authority. Professor Block is a professor of practice and executive director of the Center for Labor and a Just Economy at Harvard Law School. Mr. King is senior labor and employment counsel at the CHRO Association. Mr. Kishi is senior policy advisor at American Compass. And Mr. McDonald is shareholder and co-chair of the Workplace Policy Institute at Littler Mendelsohn PC. And I will leave it there. One last note throughout the panel, if you have any questions, we ask that you please submit them through the question and answer feature so that we will have access to them when we get to that portion of the webinar. And we also do ask that questions submitted there both pertain to this discussion and end with a question mark. And so with that, thank you for being with us today. And I will turn things over to our moderator to start the conversation.
Thank you, Sarah. That's great. And I actually do encourage people to go to the website and check out some of our panelists. We really do have an all-star group today, and I'm thrilled to be here with them. And I feel like I'm going to learn as much as our audience. It's going to be great. So I'm really eager to hear from the folks we have on this call. But before turning it over, I just want to set the stage a little bit so that everybody knows what we're talking about. The subject today, or at least the main subject, is the Faster Labor Contracts Act, hence the title. It is a bill that's moving its way through Congress. And the headline is that this bill, if passed, would amend the National Labor Relations Act, our national labor law, to allow for what's called first contract arbitration or interest arbitration on first contracts. And to give folks an idea of just what that means, I'm going to briefly explain the process that this bill would overlay onto existing federal law. So let's say that you have a union that wins an election in a new facility, a store or a processing facility, data center, somewhere. And then the union demands to bargain, as it would have a right to under the National Labor Relations Act. At that point, this new law, the Faster Labor Contracts Act, kicks in a series of deadlines. The first deadline would be that the parties, after that demand, would have to start bargaining within 10 days. That's, you know, a net new requirement. And from that point, the parties would have 90 days to hammer out a contract. That's your first 3 months to negotiate. If that 90 days pass and the parties still don't have a contract, either one of them could contact the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service, FMCS, and ask for mandatory mediation. Then another deadline would kick in. FMCS would try to mediate for the next 30 days. If mediation failed, we still don't have a contract, then FMCS would convene a panel of third-party arbitrators. This panel would have three arbitrators. One would be picked by the union, one would be picked by the employer, and there'd be one neutral. If the parties couldn't agree on a neutral, then FMCS would pick one for them. These arbitrators would be selected and appointed within 14 days. And then after that, this panel would issue an award, which would basically be the party's new contract. That contract would last for 2 years. So that's the basic process. It's not simple, but it's also not hyper complicated. And so the question, or at least the purpose here, seems to be clear, to move first contracts along quicker. It's again the title. And this idea isn't necessarily new. It has shown up in prior bills. It was in something called the Employee Free Choice Act in 2009, I believe, was that came forward, and it's been in something called the PRO Act, which has been proposed several times since 2020. So the question is, okay, so this process isn't super complicated. The purpose seems to be relatively clear. It's been in prior bills before. Why is this bill, the Faster Labor Contracts Act, getting so much attention right now? I'll posit two potential reasons. One might be its origins. The bill started as a proposal in the Senate, sponsored by Senator Josh Hawley, who's a Republican from Missouri, cutting against Tyke. And then part of it might be how far the bill has gotten to this point. It passed the House with 20 Republican votes and is now sent over to the Senate. But, you know, I think I want to hear from our experts now about the energy and the discussion behind this bill. And Professor Block, if it's okay, I'd like to start with you. You know, as I mentioned, this bill had this concept of first contract interest arbitration has shown up in a few proposals now, seems to have a lot of energy behind it. Why do people in favor of labor law reform keep coming back to this idea? What's so important about first contract interest arbitration?
Great. Thank you. And thanks for inviting me to join this panel. I mean, I don't want to even say how long I've been working on this issue, but let's just say I can remember the 2009 Employee Free Choice Act discussions over this kind of provision. So you're absolutely right. It has been a long time coming to see this kind of progress. And I agree with your basic assessment of what's giving it energy at this moment. It is certainly the labor law reform that has had broader support, and that support is actually in the House, we saw like on the record, than we've had around other labor law reform measures in recent years. But I think the real answer goes even deeper than that. So like that still begs the question of why first contract arbitration that has garnered this kind of support. I think part of it is we've had some very dramatic real world examples of the difficulty that newly certified unions have in getting employers to the bargaining table and getting negotiations for a first contract going. I think there have been a lot of studies over the years. We know a lot of people cite there was a 2009 study that showed that a third of newly certified unions never get a first contract. Also studies that show on average it takes 465 days to get to a first contract. But with the Starbucks and the Amazon campaign, successful campaigns to unionize, and the fact that there have been no collective bargaining agreements reached in those two campaigns, I think has really focused attention on this issue of how hard it is for parties to get to that first contract. I mean, those are campaigns that I think capture the popular imagination, created a dialogue about this issue in a way that few other organizing campaigns had in a while. So I think it's like that confluence of it's a long-term problem. It got sort of more public attention energy, but has as this foundation this data that it's a real problem.
That's, you know, thank you for that. I think that's a really nice summary of the strongman argument for the bill. I want to ask you, Daniel, because I mentioned in the opening that, you know, and Professor Block referenced, you know, some of the attention has to do with the bipartisan support. And I'll just ask you, we do have more conservative Republicans supporting this bill than normal for a labor bill. Why do you think that is? Why do some conservatives support this bill and this idea?
Yeah, thanks, Alex. And thanks for having me on the panel. It's an honor to be here with the panelists. You know, I would probably say there's at least a couple explanatory forces to explain that. I think, you know, first, the Republican Party's coalition has changed. Over the past dozen or so years, working class Americans, especially those without college degrees, have increasingly shifted into the Republican Party. There are, you know, of course, myriad reasons for that. Some are cultural, some are economic. But I think it's really forced Republican lawmakers to take seriously what it means to govern or legislate with the interests or concerns of working class Americans in mind. I think we can see some of this reflected in the Trump administration's trade agenda, especially its focus on reshoring production and manufacturing jobs, elements of the immigration agenda that aim to tighten the lower end of the labor market. And I think we see, you know, an increasing number of younger, more populist Republicans in Congress apply that same worker first framework to discussions of labor law reform. I think these members are reconsidering the deference the party has traditionally afforded the business community and recognize that, you know, a pro-worker agenda sometimes means strengthening the bargaining position of workers. We've done polling at American Compass that indicates that Republican voters are far more receptive to this approach than conventional wisdom might assume. Republicans have a favorable view towards labor unions. They are favorable towards certain reforms, such as laws that would inform workers of their labor rights, that would penalize violation of these labor rights, that would, in the instance of the FLCA, expedite first contracts. And this polling also really sort of underscores a generational shift that has occurred across a sort of broad swaths of policy domain, where younger Republicans are especially favorable towards organized labor and some of the reforms that are being contemplated. I would also say that, you know, strategic decisions from the labor movement or certain unions within it, especially the Teamsters, are a major force here. I think the Teamsters recognize or have come to recognize that a large share of their members vote for the Republican Party. And I think they have made a concerted effort to build relationships with Republicans on Capitol Hill, within the Trump administration, sort of those policymakers that are interested in advancing worker-oriented policy. And I think this engagement has helped build, or rather set the table for mutual trust that can make bipartisan initiatives possible. I think FLCA is well-suited for this exercise. You know, it is not a comprehensive labor reform package. It is not the PRO Act. It does not nullify state right to work laws. It does not make it easier to certify a union without a union election. It doesn't touch contentious issues of joint employer and independent contractor. Rather, it identifies a discrete problem, proposes a discrete remedy to the problem, and seeks to sort of build this bipartisan support, which at least in my mind is quite promising, or rather interesting and rather significant insofar as the American labor law is quite ossified, has been politically inert. Of course, the Wagner Act signed into law in 1935, Taft-Hartley 1947, Landrum-Griffin 1959. The healthcare amendments, which I know Roger worked on back in the 1970s, was the last substantive amendment to the NLRA. Every reform effort in the intervening 60 years has been more or less partisan, comprehensive, and ultimately unsuccessful. So I think the FLCA represents a different strategy that sort of is being executed in the context of a realigning electorate and sort of Republican lawmakers' interests in practicing responsive politics and seeing how public policy can serve the interests of American workers.
No, thank you, Daniel. And so, Roger, I want to turn to you a little bit. We've heard about some of the impetus behind the bill. We've heard about the goals and what might be driving it. But you've written that you think there are some practical problems with the implementation, and I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about those.
Certainly, Alex. Happy to do so. Thank you for including me. It's great to be with Sharon, Daniel, and Thomas this morning. So, Alex, my perspective on this is a bit different than most everyone else that's involved in the discussions. I actually negotiated collective bargaining agreements for over 40 years for all types of employers throughout the country. Many of those were first contracts. So I've actually been in the trenches and done the work that's required to get a collective bargaining agreement in place. That said, the bill's objective to bring parties together to reach a collective bargaining agreement, we don't have, I think, any disagreement. I think all of us in this panel would agree that collective bargaining in this country is a very desirable procedure and protocol for employees that choose union representation. Indeed, that's the bedrock of the Wagner Act and the NRA, encouragement of collective bargaining. This bill, unfortunately, significantly interferes with the collective bargaining process, protocols, and procedures that we've established in this country. Alex, it's not practical. There is absolutely no way that most contracts can get done in 90 days, let alone first contracts. It takes a significant amount of time to get the parties together on a schedule. It takes a significant amount of time to reach agreement on where and when negotiations will start. It takes an exceedingly difficult time to get to meaningful proposals that are discussed at the table. These are just practical realities that occur in the collective bargaining process. So the timetables that you articulated are simply not practical or realistic. And anyone that's negotiated, whether in the union side or the management side, if they're being really upfront with you, would say that. I can point to example after example that ground rules in and of themselves often take months. And that's not an employer problem or a union problem, it's a practical problem. For example, do you pay employees who are on the union negotiating committee for their negotiating time? Do you release them from work? How is the process going to work? Do you negotiate non-economic proposals first and then go to economic proposals? Confidentiality of negotiations has become a major problem with everyone being online. Are the negotiations to be kept at the bargaining table only, or are they available online for anyone? And I could go on and on. I've been involved in negotiations where smoking policies have been a problem to get ironed out. So the lack of practicality in the proposal, and there are many other problems with the Faster Labor Contract Act, but the parties that are drafting this simply don't have the experience, simply don't have the knowledge, simply don't have the understanding of collective bargaining. You know, and frankly, Alex, I think it's unfortunate. I see this proposal as an all-out assault on the collective bargaining process in this country. I agree with Sharon, there are some outliers, but we don't negotiate, and we don't put forth proposals in Congress simply because we have a few outliers. So I'll stop there. I'll be happy to come back to practical, legal, and constitutional problems with this legislation.
Yeah, no, Roger, that's really good context. I appreciate you explaining that. I want to give Thomas a chance to weigh in here. Thomas, I mean, you've written about some practical concerns with the proposal as well. You've also talked a little bit about, I've heard you talk a little bit about some precedents with and experiments with interest arbitration. So, I don't know, what's your perspective on this? I mean, do you see the same practical problems that Roger does?
I definitely see those practical problems, and I think that there's no doubt. I mean, it's great. Like Roger, I spent decades negotiating in the retail sector, the manufacturing sector, the transportation sector, the communication sector. I was either at tables or in caucus rooms at a great many collective bargaining sessions involving many different unions and employers. And look, it's great if you can reach an agreement everybody can live with pretty quickly. And I've seen it happen surprisingly quickly, despite the complexity that Roger correctly laid out in reaching a first contract, I've seen it happen in 3 or 4 months if everybody comes to the table and they're reasonable. But it can take longer. And I think that there's some things to remember that are sort of countervailing considerations to the portrayal that the proponents of FLCA always try to use to characterize, you know, how long the delays are and why the delays happen. And if you listen to the proponents, it's always employers dragging their feet. And it's employers who don't want first contracts. And I can tell you from my own experience, that happens sometimes. But let's remember, as Roger said, how complex a first contract is. You're not just bargaining about what employees are going to be paid. You're bargaining about their what are their medical benefits going to look like, and what kind of premiums are they going to pay, and are they going to have any control over their own schedules, and what kind of control, and how's discipline going to work, and are there going to be productivity standards, and what are the productivity standards going to look like, and what are the work rules are going to be. So, you know, there are easily 30 or 40 or 50 different provisions that probably need to be negotiated in a first contract. So there's a great deal of complexity from the outset. And listen, the reality is it's not just employers that drag their feet. Unions drag their feet too sometimes. And I can tell you, I have a client that has retail locations that have been organized over the last 2 or 3 years. And that union hasn't even ask for bargaining for months and months and months. In fact, at a couple of locations, a year has gone by and they never requested the first bargaining session. Another consideration is that let's remember, when parties are negotiating a first contract, what activity immediately preceded that? Well, the activity that immediately preceded it, absent a neutrality agreement, was likely a very hard-fought organizing campaign where a labor union, like a politician, was seeking votes. And so in my 30-plus years of doing this, I have observed that unions routinely promise during campaigns all sorts of benefits that they're going to negotiate for the employees who they want to vote yes for them, that the union knows the employer will never give them. So oftentimes, and this is based on my experience, oftentimes you see a union enter into negotiations for a first contract and it's painted itself into a corner with all the promises it has made, that it takes a long time and a lot of bargaining to help the union extricate itself from the corner into which it painted itself. So delays can happen for reasons on both sides. But let me get to kind of the nefarious consequences of mandatory bargaining, the prospect of mandatory bargaining. And this is a different practical problem. And proponents have argued that the FLCA will motivate parties to reach agreements so that they don't have to go to arbitration. And I think we have recent evidence that probably the reverse of that is true. And it's in the form of arbitration legislation that Congress passed in the healthcare sector. And it was called the No Surprises Act. And I could give you chapter and verse of what the 4.5 to 5 years of experience shows us under the No Surprises Act. But essentially what happened in the No Surprises Act is you have a healthcare provider that provides services to a patient. You have a health plan that is supposed to pay the provider for the services, and they can't agree what the payment will be. So Congress said, well, when this happens and the provider and the payer can't agree on what the price should be, we're going to send them into arbitration. And we now have several years of experience under this. And what we have seen is the number of arbitrations that providers are that medical providers are demanding to get themselves paid have skyrocketed tens and hundreds of fold more than what the writers of the bill anticipated. In the first year, they thought there would be about 22,000 arbitrations. In fact, there were more than 200,000. And 4 or 5 years later, we're getting 2 and 3 million arbitration demands by healthcare providers who want to get paid. And the healthcare providers, last year, they were paid $15 billion by health plans under this arbitration process, which is an amount of money that Congress never, ever imagined would be transferred from health plans to healthcare providers under this mandatory arbitration system. But what we saw happen was the dynamic is a provider wants payment from a healthcare plan, and the provider says, oh, I want to extract a benefit here from my counterparty. So rather than really negotiate with them about something reasonable, I want to scuttle negotiations. I want to make maximalist demands. I want to go to arbitration, and arbitrators are going to give me something. I have a chance, all upside and no downside, of getting far more than what I would get through normal negotiations. And we've seen there have been studies by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and others who have looked at how this arbitration process has played out. And we have arbitrators giving healthcare providers wins in almost 9 out of 10 cases. And in many cases, they're paying like they're awarding amounts that are hundreds of times what the healthcare provider's standard fee would be. And let me give you just one example that the New York Times called out. There is a plastic surgery practice that operates in New York and New Jersey. And through the arbitration process, they were awarded $1.4 million for five, count them five, routine breast reduction procedures. So that's about $280,000 on average for a breast reduction procedure. So this shows us the perverse and unintended consequences that can occur that can completely scuttle good faith negotiated agreements when Congress says, oh, we have a solution when people have trouble reaching agreement.
There's a lot there, Thomas. I appreciate that. Mr. Block, I want to circle back and give you an opportunity to respond to some of that. I mean, from what I heard, you know, practical concerns falling into basically two buckets. One, about the timelines. Perhaps, you know, the bill's timelines aren't reasonable for negotiating a first contract. Maybe the delays we've heard about aren't unreasonable. And the other one that I think was where Thomas was going was that this may, you know, having backstop, an arbitration backstop may affect bargaining behavior in ways that are undesirable. What do you think about those practical problems? I mean, just steel manning the bill, what would you say the best responses are?
So the first point I would say, the parties can always extend that 90-day period. And so I wonder if is it really unrealistic to have a sense, Roger, to your point about maybe you can't negotiate everything in 90 days, but I think the parties would probably have a sense, again, with a renewed incentive to get down to business, whether staying within their, you know, private ordering type of collective bargaining, whether that's going to be a fruitful path or not. So again, in highly complex negotiations, maybe the parties will want more time. But this puts that, gives them that incentive to figure that out pretty quickly. And also say, I mean, I think to say that this undermines collective bargaining, the whole institutional collective bargaining, let's remember this is only applies to first contracts, for contracts that would be in place for 2 years. That's a shorter period of time than most collective bargaining agreements that parties negotiate on their own. And so also looking at those incentives on each side as to whether to get to that the arbitrator or not. Unions, my experience is unions usually want longer contracts, so they are giving up something by going the arbitration route, because under the bill, the contracts are only going to be in place for 2 years. And you know, there is, I think it's really hard to argue that we don't have a problem with getting to first contracts. You know, the empirical evidence of how often unions have to bring failure to bargain in good faith, surface bargaining, which is a very weak doctrine, but yet unions still have to bring these cases, just shows the difficulty in that particular context of first contract negotiations. You know, Thomas, to your point about unions that don't even ask for bargaining, well, then the 10 days doesn't kick off until that request for bargaining has been made. And then last, to the point that you start bargaining on the heels of this very contentious experience of going through the campaign, there are other reforms that I think we should put in place that would maybe bring the temperature down on those campaigns, so that maybe you're not starting negotiations from that incredibly long fought, drawn out experience of an organizing campaign. So I think we have to think about this. I think this is would be an important step, but I definitely don't think that this is the only step that we need to take to find a more productive, positive, constructive way of doing collective bargaining in our country.
No, and Daniel, let me go to you, because Professor Block does a nice job of explaining the philosophy of the bill toward the timing issue. And I'd like your perspective on this concern that's been raised about how interest arbitration might affect bargaining behavior. Do you have any concerns about how it might affect behavior at the table, maybe strategic bargaining driving toward an arbitration rather than agreement? Are you concerned about all that, or do you think the bill would have a different practical effect?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would absolutely have an effect on the bargaining relationship. And it's probably important to remember that the consequences of a delayed first contract are asymmetric. If the parties fail to reach a first contract, employers can maintain, or generally do maintain, the status quo terms and conditions of employment for the workers. Meanwhile, workers who have voted to unionize, who have exercised their labor rights, are denied the benefits of that collective bargaining agreement. I think Professor Block alluded to sort of the effects of these delay tactics that some employers employ, but workers within a bargaining unit leave, new workers are hired. There can be frustration sort of with the union, or momentum can erode. And so, at least to my mind, it's arguably rational in some instances for employers that oppose the union to simply drag their feet and surface bargain and negotiate, but not truly in good faith. So FLCA changes this calculation. If bargaining fails, either party may request arbitration. It's not required to do so. And then an arbitration will eventually establish a binding contract. So in my mind, arbitration in this instance is a backstop. It's a forcing function. The availability of this mechanism should encourage both parties to prepare for negotiation sooner, make serious proposals sooner, negotiate within sort of a credible range of outcomes that a neutral party might reasonably support. And so for employers, I think that this prospect of binding arbitration provides a rather strong incentive to truly bargain in good faith and reach an agreement. I would imagine that most employers would rather negotiate and have a hand in writing that contract than sort of flipping a coin and seeing what the arbitration panel hands down. And I also think that some employer advocates, or some that oppose FLCA, might argue that unions themselves might prefer arbitration, that they might choose under the FLCA to run out the clock, send it to mediation, convene a panel. And while I do think that unions would value that backstop, a guarantee that a contract would eventually be reached, I don't think it necessarily follows that the unions would prefer arbitration. Unions, when they're negotiating a contract, a panel might side with them on wages, but they might side with management on scheduling. They might, management rights, any number of other issues that, like the business, the union runs the same risk that the arbitration panel will hand down terms that are, inferior or unsatisfactory to its members. I also don't think that it's necessarily the case. Thomas, of course, referenced the surprise billing legislation that has been covered pretty extensively in the press. I'm not sure how well a sort of mahemoth American healthcare system maps onto particular bargaining relationships in small localities across the country. But I don't necessarily think that it's obvious to me that a union would or an employer for that matter, would submit to the arbitration panel an extreme position on any of these terms. I mean, the arbitration panel is sort of directed to sort of render a award on various benchmarks, including the employer's finances and the compensation of comparable businesses. So I think that if a union were to ask for a wage or a condition that was so outside the norm or well above the median of what, workers, similarly situated workers in that geographical region or what have you have, it's not obvious to me that the panel would view that very favorably. I think the principal effect of the FLCA would be to produce more voluntary agreements in the shadow of a credible endpoint, which is the availability of interest arbitration.
Roger, I actually want to kick it over to you on that. I'm interested in this concept that Daniel's introduced, this forcing function. So there's this idea behind the bill, which we've heard, our other panelists referred to, that there's an incentive under current labor law for a employer not to bargain, to drag its feet, and perhaps this has something to do with the penalty structure. I wonder what your response to that is and whether you think, this is an appropriate fix for that gap or whether we might have other downstream effects we may not be thinking about.
Certainly, Alex, I'll get to that in a moment. I just want to briefly respond. I totally agree with Thomas. The expectancy of the bargaining unit in first contracts is a major consideration. I've had many union leaders come to me in first contract situations and say, we need more time, Roger. We're going to have to bargain through the expectancy issue. So that's a very real practical issue. Second, the complexity of bargaining has increased dramatically over the years. For our first contract to reach agreement on healthcare insurance and healthcare provisions for the unit, which are very important, that is complex. It takes time. We've had increasingly numbers of social political proposals being made. We have AI proposals that are now seeping into the bargaining process. So a first contract can be exceedingly complex. As Thomas mentioned, you have 40, 50 or more subjects to consider. On the two-year situation, Sharon, you're right, the bill provides for no more than 2 years, but that's really misleading because under the Supreme Court's doctrine, the Katz doctrine, a party cannot, employer or union, unilaterally change a term of a collective bargaining agreement. And as you know, under Katz, all terms and conditions, but for a few minor exceptions, continue even after the contract term has expired. Most people don't understand that. A significant difference between common law contract law and federal contract law is that the entire agreement, but for very few exceptions, as I note, continues in perpetuity. So, in fact, what the parties are agreeing to in a first contract really is a decades-long proposition. And I could go on as to practical and legal issues, but Alex, back to your point. I agree. We need to do a better job in collective bargaining in first contracts. There are some significant outliers. Starbucks is not a good example. The Starbucks union tried to change the ground rules after they successfully organized single store units. The employer had requested multi-location bargaining units. The union objected, the NLRB agreed with the union. But then after that election process was completed, the union wanted to negotiate on a regional basis. They wanted to change the entire ground rules. So there are some real factual explanations why Starbucks is a complex and difficult situation. Do we need remedies, Alex? I guess that's really the heart of your question. Do we need remedies other than 8A5? You have to go back if you're guilty of an 8A5 failure to bargain and bargain again. I think that's a worthy question to consider. But if we're going to consider remedies for rogue unions and rogue employers, and there are both unions and employers that have misused the process, we need to look at it in a much more holistic process, as Sharon mentioned. We need to talk about labor law reform in a much broader context. And I think many employers would be willing to do that. But the Faster Labor Contract Act is a significant adverse impediment into collective bargaining. And finally, the realistic impact on collective bargaining in this bill, people haven't thought through. I, like Thomas, have negotiated agreements, but I've also negotiated agreements where we have interest arbitration, like the FLLCA has. I can tell you what happens in that process. The employer stays low, the union stays high, knowing that we're going to have arbitration and knowing that the arbitrators are probably going to come in somewhere in the middle. So it slows down bargaining. It discourages meaningful bargaining. It's not a good process. And to try to compare what happens in the public sector to the private sector is not a valid comparison. So in summary, Alex, I would certainly, as one, welcome a discussion about a broader labor law reform discussion that's fair to both employers and employees and employees. Final point, this legislation will not permit employees to vote on any arbitrable imposed collective bargaining agreement. They're taken out of the picture altogether. That's not a good policy. I'm not sure there's even a right to strike, frankly. That's a whole different discussion. If an arbitration panel imposes a contract, the employees are taken out of the process entirely. That's not good policy.
No, thank you, Roger. And Thomas, I want to go to you because Roger started to refer to some of the legal implications of the bill. He referenced the Katz Doctrine, which essentially just means the first contract sets the floor. There's no unilateral change until we agree to something else. I wonder about your reaction to that. What downstream effects, applying Katz to an agreement that was reached through interest arbitration could have, and whether there are any other legal aspects or concerns that folks have been thinking about or that concern you with this proposal?
Yeah, I think I really just want to agree with Roger that that 2 years. I agree with Sharon that all things being equal, a union would probably rather have a 3, 4, or 5 year contract than a 2 year contract. So in that sense, the legislation doesn't give them something they would typically want. But Roger makes a very good point that that first contract is critical. And I've negotiated some first contracts and I've negotiated lots and lots of successor contracts. And that first contract really sets the stage for what the parties' bargaining relationship will look like and what the terms and conditions of employment will look like for years and years and years to come. And so it's really important, that the first contract doesn't just go away after 2 years. The first contract under Katz stays in place. So there's really a lot of inertia that generates. And because we keep talking about contracts, I want to sort of detour for just a moment and make what I think is kind of an important rhetorical point. Everybody I know who writes or talks about the FLCA, they talk about it in terms of, well, arbitrators will write the first contract or arbitrators will determine the first agreement. But it's actually not a contract or an agreement. Whatever results from the mandatory arbitration process under the Faster Labor Contracts Act is not a contract and it is not an agreement. It is an edict it is a top-down edict about what the terms and conditions of employment will be in a workplace that is issued by an agent of the federal government. So, for those of us who think this legislation is a bad idea, I'd like to encourage everybody to maybe change your language and not talk about how arbitrators are going to write a first contract or an agreement, because that's not what it will be. It will be a government regulation imposed by a federal agent. But now let me try to get back to what I think your question was, Alex. In terms of the legal problems with the FLCA, it is plagued by a rich array of constitutional infirmities. And the litigator in me almost wants to see it enacted so that I can enjoy the many judicial challenges that it would inevitably face. I think most importantly, to get back to the point I made a moment ago about how these arbitrators are agents of the federal government, what that means is if we get a first contract, in quotes, that is imposed by federally mandated arbitrators, then every term in that contract becomes state action that has to comply with the United States Constitution. And so, you know, in my experience, for example, it is not unusual that a collective bargaining agreement would allow union representatives access to the workplace to inspect certain working conditions or to meet with the employees they represent. Well, if that is put in a, if an arbitrator imposes that term on an employer, then we have challenges under the Fifth Amendment for a taking, and we have challenges under the Fourth Amendment for warrantless search and seizure. In other collective bargaining agreements I have been involved with, it's not unusual for the parties to agree that they will act respectfully towards one another, and they will refrain from making derogatory comments about one another during the term of the contract. Well, if an arbitrator imposes that sort of provision, then we're going to have First Amendment challenges for infringements on free expression. If we have an arbitrator say the union gets access to employee break rooms in the workplace to post notices for employees to see, we have another First Amendment challenge, because the employer is being ordered by an agent of the federal government to allow certain kinds of expression in the workplace that the employer may not want. So let me count the ways of the constitutional challenges that would flow from every provision imposed by an arbitrator being state action. Also, a little more nuance here, but given the regulatory power that they wield, arbitrators under the FLCA function essentially as inferior officers under the United States Constitution's Appointments Clause, but they're not selected in any way that is contemplated by the Constitution. So we have people wielding government regulatory authority who are appointed to do so in a way that the Constitution doesn't really accept or contemplate. And there's a non-delegation problem in that arbitrators are private parties. Go to the FMCS website, and they sort of put in prominent language, our mediators and our arbitrators are not employees of the federal government. So these are private parties who, again, they're endowed with significant regulatory power, yet they answer to no higher politically accountable official or tribunal or body. So that creates a real non-delegation problem. And there's an even more basic due process problem, kind of adjacent, in that arbitrators are granted this significant regulatory power, but the authorizing legislation provides very little limit, essentially no limit, on how it is wielded. Perhaps more importantly, there's zero opportunity to appeal to any Article III court or any other tribunal or any other official, whatever the arbitrator imposes. So it is literally true, I'm not saying likely, but it is literally true under the Faster Labor Contracts Act, an arbitrator could decree that every worker on a plant's assembly line must be paid $1,000 an hour, or $2,000 an hour, or $4,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 an hour, bankrupting the employer. And the Faster Labor Contracts Act offers no oversight, none, zero, on the arbitrator imposing this obligation on the employer, and it offers absolutely no way to appeal.
So there's a lot there, Thomas. Professor Black, I'll give you an opportunity to respond to any of that you'd like. I also, just for the entire panel, and we can go around, we've gotten some questions from the audience, and beyond the legal issues, I'd like to circle back on some practical concerns. Questioner from the audience asks about contract ratification. So it's common in collective bargaining today for the employees to vote to ratify a contract once it's reached between the union and the employer. The questioner asks, well, that doesn't seem to be part of the process contemplated by the first contract arbitration in the FLCA. And Professor Block, I wonder if we can start with you, unless you want to address the legal concerns that Thomas raised, on whether you think that is a concern that needs to be addressed with this piece of legislation.
Again, I'm happy to share some thoughts on that, on the ratification process. My reading of the bill is that it doesn't provide for ratification. Again, I think some of this comes back to the necessity of getting a contract in, or a whatever we want to call it, an agreement into place expeditiously. I think it also goes to the fact that these are two-year agreements. So again, the union is going to have, the employees are going to have a chance to inform their leadership about how they feel about what came out of the process. Unions all have internal processes for ensuring that they get input from their members, because let's remember, like, the ultimate check on what the union provides to the arbitrator, what they are willing to accept through that process, is governed by a democratic process. Unions are democracies. And so I think that's, we don't live in our political democracy by plebiscite, right? We have representative democracy, and unions, in fact, follow that model. And so I think, union leadership that I know are acutely aware of the fact that they will be facing the voters, their members, who will act upon how well they think they've negotiated contracts. So I think that's probably the best explanation of why it's acceptable and how this the bill came together, and how, again, I didn't draft this bill, but I think how, at least on the union side, folks think about the fact that there is not a ratification of the arbitrator's decision, but there's that democracy hanging over union leadership's head at all times.
Daniel, let me ask you, from your perspective, this is the absence of ratification a problem with the bill, or is Perhaps Blanc is suggesting union internal democratic processes are enough to satisfy that concern, that ultimately what the union puts forward will be reflective of the members' desires?
Yeah, I mean, I would have to think about how this would change the mechanics of the bill in its totality, but it's not obvious to me why a simple sort of amendment on the back end, that the agreement or contract handed down by the arbitrators should be subject to a ratification vote. I think that could, in some sense, resolve concerns with sort of worker agency in this final contract. I would also think that if they were given the vote, I would imagine that the vast majority of, contracts would in fact be ratified. And so far as the, collective action will result in upward pressure on the wages and conditions of their employment, so it will be superior to the status quo under which they have heretofore worked. And I guess I would also say that, I may have lost my third point.
That's okay.
Point two. Apologies. Maybe it'll come back to me.
No, that's all right. Roger, let me kick it to you then. So we've heard, Daniel suggesting that perhaps, if this ratification gap is a concern, maybe it could be fixed with amendments. There are other, what do you think about that? And are there other amendments that the bill's author should be considering that might make it more palatable to a broader group? I know you've thought a lot about potential amendments to the FLCA. So what do you think about that?
Well, certainly any legislation can be improved. I'm not sure, however, this legislation can survive constitutionally. I totally agree with Thomas that if this bill were to become law, it's dead on arrival in the courts on state action constitutional problems that are many more complex than we have time to discuss today. To the question about employee involvement and the suggestion that Daniel made, well, perhaps this imposed document, and Daniel's right, it's not, or Thomas is right, it's not an agreement. This imposed set of terms and conditions of employment could be subject to employee bargaining unit vote. Well, the employer then also should have a right to say no. If you're going to go down that route, you have to make it equal for both employer and employee. But Alex, beyond the constitutional problems, which are exceedingly numerous, you have basic statutory issues with this bill that the proponents have not thought out at all. There's no discussion at all in the bill of a union's right and an employer right to challenge the definition of the bargaining unit and to take that issue into the Federal Court of Appeals. I don't know what happens to that right under this legislation. I'm assuming it still would be present, but then that interferes with the so-called timeline that's imposed. So what about that statutory right, or at least that right at present that unions and employers have to challenge the LRB's definition of the basic bargaining unit? What about the impasse doctrine, where the parties reach a legitimate stalemate? Is that nullified altogether by this legislation? You know, Alex, the bottom line is the proponents of this bill simply don't know labor law very well, and or they know labor law and they don't want to consider basic tenets that have been in place for decades. This is essentially a Teamster-sponsored bill because they have problems negotiating with Amazon. I mean, let's just be honest about it. And we shouldn't be drafting legislation because two parties have difficulty reaching an agreement. Back to what Sharon has suggested, you know, maybe we should have a broader discussion. Certainly, I know she's done a lot of work and research in the whole area of labor law reform. Again, I'd be willing to have that discussion. I'm sure others in the employer community would, if it's an even-handed discussion. But the PRO Act is the most one-sided piece of labor legislation, to my knowledge, ever introduced in the Congress. And what we're talking about today is simply a small part of that. If we want to address first contracts, let's talk about maybe mandatory arbitration. Let's talk about perhaps advisory panels of arbitrators that could suggest on a suggested board of inquiry type process like we have in the healthcare amendments, results of how the contract might be finalized. I think thoughtful approaches like this, but interest arbitration in the private sector is not a good idea. It's a significant interference with collective bargaining, and it should be rejected.
Thank you, Roger. And Thomas, we've gotten a lot of questions about legal issues with the bill. So I'll just try to wrap up and give you one of these. I mean, we've gotten questions about whether the arbitrator's decision would be reviewable in court, whether it could include terms that don't that aren't normally subject to bargaining under the NLRA. I don't know. I mean, so from your reading of the bill, does the bill answer these questions, or are we still going to have to figure this out once it?
Well, I'd love to hear if somebody disagrees with me. And you know, I know Sharon's read the bill. Everybody here has read the bill very carefully. As I said, it doesn't contemplate it, as Daniel pointed out correctly a little while ago, it gives some general guidelines or some considerations, some factors that arbitrators are supposed to take into account, although it doesn't really indicate how they're supposed to weigh or how they should be weighted or how they should count. And, if the arbitrator is supposed to take into account wages given by comparable employers in the sector, does that mean they're supposed to give higher wages or lower wages or the same wages? All the unions I know think that there should be a union premium. And so if you have a newly unionized employer in a sector that's mostly not unionized, that union's going to say, well, our employees should be paid more than all the other employees in this sector because we should get the union premium. So is the arbitrator supposed to give the union premium, or is the arbitrator supposed to give comparable wages? We don't know. The bill doesn't tell us. But if you take it at its face, there is absolutely... it doesn't provide any oversight or any check or any review on whatever an arbitrator decrees will be the terms and conditions of employment. Now, we know that, as I pointed out, the terms and conditions will ultimately be subject to challenge. Every one of them will be subject to constitutional challenge because every one of them will be state action because it's imposed by an agent of the federal government. But the bill itself doesn't acknowledge this, and the bill itself doesn't say, look, employer, if you don't like the wages that the arbitrator imposes, you know, you can go to this government official and have some oversight, or you can go to court and have some oversight. The bill doesn't provide for any review of any kind or any appeal.
Sure.
So I think we could probably keep having this discussion for another 2 hours, but we do have to give folks their time back. So let me send it back over to the Federalist Society to be able to close us out. But before I do that, I just really want to thank everybody for this really, really great discussion. I feel like we got into a lot of substance. It's a worthy debate we're going to keep having, I think.
Thanks, Alex. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I just want to thank our experts again for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise. It was a wonderful conversation. And I also just want to thank our audience for joining and participating today. We always welcome listener feedback, if you have some, by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, please keep an eye on our website and on your emails for any announcements about upcoming virtual events. Thank you all so much for joining us today, and we are adjourned.
Thanks for listening to FedSoc Forums, a Federalist Society podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you won't miss an episode. To learn more, visit our website, fedsoc.org.